an opinions or some opinions on what BEA is doing, and particularly kind of what Patrick feels. I'm actually not going to give you too many opinions unless you ask me, because I want to make sure that people understand the technology before they get all of the stuff that that gets thrown at them. Now, that's still okay. I mean, that's good that that we're able to give you some taste of development using JPA and some of the things that you can watch out for. But there will be lots more to say as you begin to use JPA, and we're looking forward to doing that in the coming months, now that JPA has become final. So my name is Mike Keith. I'm the co-specification lead on the EJB3 spec, which includes the components as well as the Java Persistence API. The Java Persistence API is a subject of this talk. We did the component talk yesterday, and as I mentioned yesterday, I'll kind of go through the kind of ground-up approach to explaining the Java Persistence API, and then hopefully get a chance to answer any more advanced questions if you have any later on. So just to give you a feeling for how we got here and why we are here, this was actually part of the JSR 220 expert group. And the JSR 220, as I mentioned, was EJB3, and JPA was kind of branched from that in terms of a technology. Right now it's being released as part of EJB3. It started off as being, how do we make entity beans better? And as you know, the result is pretty much nothing like entity beans. It's sort of the opposite of an entity bean, really. We don't even call them entity beans anymore. We call them entities. So to prevent confusion, if you see entity bean, what that means is it's a component, the old EJB 2.1 entity bean. 3.0, actually, the JPA includes entities. The rest is just kind of historical, mostly. Everybody really wanted to get this stuff out there. They wanted it to be easy to use. They wanted it to be something that people were, in effect, already using, but standardizing what people were already using in terms of the persistence products that were out there. So the features are primarily that entities are POJOs. They're not these abstract classes a la EJB 2.1. They are not anything like a type of class that has to extend some other class or a superclass, anything that has to implement some particular interface. There are no particular constraints that are involved with programming and developing entities in JPA. They're just regular objects. And although chances are you will want to develop these as entities, you don't have to. They can be any object that can become an entity. So in order to make something persistible, you simply have to annotate it or list it in some XML file describing it as an entity. The additional basically object-oriented features of entities were just there because they should be there. They weren't there before, and they were missing, and there was no reason why they shouldn't have been there. They should have been there all along. But the problem was that they weren't POJOs, and they didn't follow a lot of the same rules as Java objects followed. So now that they are Java objects, they should and will follow every other Java object-oriented paradigm that you are using with your other types of development. The query language was expanded in the form of Java Persistence Query Language, which was mentioned already. It is a superset of EJBQL. It's got most of the extra features that were missing from EJBQL, and a few things that were simplified from what EJBQL required. And the object relational mapping was a piece that was a gargantuan piece that was missing from the previous specifications, where nobody could really take an object relational mapping and port it from one server to another, because every server or persistence product had their own way to map objects. They were all essentially the same information in there, they just were different formats. Right? The object relational mapping space is well known and well understood. It's very seasoned and mature. There was just no actual common specification for mapping that into the database. So that's been done. And of course, in addition, as you've heard now, there's this other API that allows you to use entities outside of an EJB container or a Java EE container for that matter altogether. And you can take JPA and run it in a regular client application. And talk to the database directly without even being on a server. The pluggable persistence providers was kind of an added benefit that we added on near the end of the phase. That ended up being a little more work than I thought it would be. I thought it would be because, at Oracle, we'd done a lot of... So I worked for Oracle in what was once the Toplink division, and now it involves the EJB container and everything else. And, we had a lot of integrations with a lot of servers, and we'd done that a number of times and had pretty much solved that problem to a T. So I thought it would be pretty easy to do this. It turned out that, everybody kind of solves that problem a little bit differently. So as usual, there's a lot of back and forth thing. But what we ended up with, I think, is something that everybody can live with and everybody can actually make use of. So there's features in this SPI or this pluggability contract that allows a persistence provider to fit itself into any EJB3 or JPA compliant container. Now, a container is sort of a loose construct now, too, because typically an EJB container was what you thought of. But now, given that JPA is sort of the separate specification in a way, or a separate document, a separate standard, you can actually have anybody becoming a compliant JPA container. And, in fact, Spring has just released, or is releasing in their 2.0, a compliance with JPA in the sense that where they are actually a JPA compliant container, and they can host any JPA provider. So you have, this kind of line is blurring now between what is able to host JPA. And as I said, of course, you don't even need a host in the end. You can actually, if you want to, if you don't want to run on any server at all, just run the Bootstrap, what we call the Bootstrap API in Java SE. Okay, getting a little bit more specific about the Java objects themselves. I mentioned that you don't need any interfaces, they're regular objects, so the way you create a regular object is you new it up and you go ahead and use it. And so there's nothing specific that you have to do, nothing special. The only requirement that, I wouldn't say the only requirement, the main requirement I would say that entities have is that they have to have some notion of identity. And identity not being Java identity in the sense of persistence. So there has to be something in the object that identifies it from all of the other objects of the same type. So that's what we call persistent identity, and that is equates naturally to the primary key in the database. Now, when you have an entity, the typical case is that all of the state in that entity is persistent. So you have a bunch of state and a bunch of behavior, and the state gets persisted to the database when the occasion arises, at commit time or whatever. The requirement is not that all of your state be persistent. In fact, there are cases where you only want part of your state to be persistent. So you can make transient state within a persistent object. They don't have to be serializable themselves, but they can have serializable state. They can be serializable as well, particularly if you want to take the thing and ship it off somewhere else. But again, that's not a requirement. The state may be any of the sort of basic state that you might expect it to be. And, of course, it might be relationships as well to other entities. Entity inheritance exists, as I mentioned, so you can extend both entity classes and non-entity classes. So as an entity class, you can inherit from a transient class above you, if that is applicable to your application. It's a little bit less common, I would expect, but nevertheless. So here's an example of an entity. Most of you have been here for the previous talk, so you know that this entity annotation exists for the sole purpose of demarcating this as an entity object. I'll see if I can find a pointer in here somewhere. And the ID annotation indicates that this is the persistent identity here. So we see some other annotations here called embedded and transient, and you can guess what transient means. And embedded just means that this object is actually a part of its enclosing object. It doesn't exist on its own. You can't query for it or do anything special with that. It's kind of a subpart of this entity, customer. So an address here doesn't exist on its own. It doesn't have its own identity, and you can't, as I say, query over it or relate it or anything like that. And then you kind of get some other methods that you might have in your entity. You might have a bunch of other accessing state, or accessing behavior rather, or perhaps even business logic. So I said that every entity has to have a persistence identity. That should be a persistent identity. But that's the thing that is the primary key in the database. And what we have actually three different kinds of identities or persistent identities in an entity. The most common one is you just use the @ID annotation, and that is used for a simple type, an integer or a string or something like that, that you might have as the primary key in your database. But you can also have these things called embedded IDs or ID classes. Now, embedded ID means that I have a composite primary key, and the primary key class that encloses all the state of that primary key is a field in my entity. So I could have a customer that had a primary key of name and birth date, say, and I could have a customer primary key class that had name and birth date fields in it, and in my customer class, I would have a custPK field of type customerPK, right? So that's my field definition. Now, the other kind is closely related to EJB 2.1, which is the ID class scheme. The ID class means that you have this primary key class, which represents, again, composite primary keys. But in this case, you don't have a field in your customer called custPK. You actually have the name and the birth date spelled out inside of the customer class. So again, this is like the EJB 2.1 scheme where you had to enumerate all of the different fields of the primary key inside of your entity. That's mainly for compatibility, although some people still like that scheme. And of course, primary keys may be generated automatically. In this case, you'd use a generated value annotation on the primary key in your entity. And you can define different types of generation, such as using a sequence in the database or using a table in the database. So these are different types of actually having, or you can just say auto and let the persistence provider define what it wants to do and go ahead and do it. So you don't have to be worried or concerned about what it actually chose. So on the relationship side, the basic types of relationships are offered, the one-to-one, one-to-many, many-to-one, and many-to-many, with different cardinalities on both sides. And the collection types themselves might be of the various collection types that you see. The directionality is up to you. You can choose whether you want it to be unidirectional or bidirectional. There are some caveats about unidirectionality of multiple relationship types, or the M-valued one-to-many relationships that you would have to be aware of. The key, though, when you talk about relationships, if they're bidirectional, is that there's two sides to every relationship. We have to name these sides so that you kind of sort them out and hook them together. And so we name them the owning side and the inverse side. Now, the owning side is just the side of the relationship that has the foreign key in it. So you can think of things in the database side that there is going to be some one side or the other that actually refers to the other side. Right? That's the only way you can relate these two things together, is there's some persistent relationship. So the side that actually has that foreign key in it, we call the owning side. And so the other side we just call the inverse side or the non-owning side. And just understanding those two things will get you quite far in being able to define all the relationships that you have inside of your domain model. So here's an example. We have a customer that has a bunch of orders. So we have a one-to-many annotation here that says there are many orders within this customer. And I'm using the generic form here. That's the simplest way to indicate it. As was mentioned already in Patrick's talk, generics are a handy thing to use, both for simplicity and, in one way, I guess, documentation. But I think what we didn't talk too much about was the actual structure and typing of the language. I mean, the idea that you have a collection and can type what sorts of things you can store in that collection, and that collection is actually type-controlled at compile time, is very helpful. That structures your program much more than what we had before. So you're not going to get the same runtime exceptions that you would have gotten before, potentially. So this would be the most structured way of defining this. Now, you don't need to use generics here. It's supported just to have a set of orders here, and then in the annotation you have to say what the target entity type was so that the provider could actually map it to the right entity target type. So if I did just put a set of orders and didn't put a generic form of this set in here, I would have to say that the target entity here was order class, or the order entity. So getting back to our relationship discussion again, the many-to-one is really the other side of the one-to-many. But in this case, actually, it's not the other side of this one-to-many. Because this many-to-one doesn't even match this one, because it's not pointing to a customer here. It's not actually in the customer. It's not in this order class pointing to the customer. This is just another many-to-one relationship inside of a customer pointing to a sales rep. So any number of customers may point to a single sales rep. And we would expect the other side of that relationship to be in the sales rep class, just like we would expect the other side, if this was a bidirectional relationship, to be in the order class. It turns out that there is no other side to this relationship. How do I know that? Just by looking at this class without looking at order. Well, I know that because a one-to-many is always, in a bidirectional relationship, always the inverse side, because it never has the foreign key in it. It's always the many-to-one back that would have the foreign key. So a one-to-many, if it's in a bidirectional relationship, would have to have this extra bit that pointed to the other side of it. It would have to have a mapped by. And the mapped by in here would show that this is the other side of this relationship, so when it comes time to mapping, you can join the two together, or at least the provider can do that for you. So here we actually see that the sales rep is the other side of that previous one. So if you go back here to the many-to-one, to sales rep from customer, now sales rep is a bidirectional one, and we see the mapped by is the rep. What's the rep mean? Well, the rep is just the attribute within customer that is the many-to-one relationship. So you point back to the other side, and you point back to the attribute that is the related attribute. And the rest is the same sort of thing. Here we're annotating the state, and you can have some getter method here that accesses that state. And if you actually want to add a customer on, then adding a customer to the sales rep means that you add that customer in, but you also set this pointer back from the customer to you. So this is a change from the EJB 2.1 entity beans, where you had this magic going on under the covers and relationships were managed for you. Now, we gave that up when we wanted to go to POJOs, right? Because these aren't managed the same way by the container as POJOs used to be, as entity beans used to be. As POJOs, they may not be managed at all, in the sense where the container is tracking them all over the place. They may just be a simple object sitting out there in some space, and you're changing things on it. Now, they may be managed, right? And they may be in some managed state, but they may not be. So, as a result, you can't actually say that you can rely on the container managing this relationship for you, and you have to do some of that management yourself. And I always relate this to the doubly linked list that you always had to put together when you were going through the early computer science courses. And you had to learn, well, okay, if I'm putting something in the middle, I got to fix up my pointers back and forth. It doesn't matter what language you're using, you have to make sure that people are pointing to the right other people, or customers pointing to the right other customers, or whatever it is that you're talking about. So with inheritance, we talked about you can extend a non-entity class, but in fact, an entity class itself can be abstract. It doesn't necessarily even have to be a concrete class itself. Why would you want an entity to be abstract? Well, just for the same reason that you want any class to be abstract. It has a bunch of behavior, and that behavior is shared, and you may want to query over a bunch of other sub-entities, but at a superclass level. So I may want to have a superclass called Animal that is abstract and some subclasses of Animal, and I want to query over all the animals. Now, I can't instantiate an animal. I have to instantiate some concrete instance of Animal, which is a particular type of animal. But I want to find stuff about animals out. So the same reason holds for persistence. And so there's no reason why you can't have an abstract entity, just like you can in Java with POJOs. A map superclass is a somewhat different variety of entity. In fact, it's not really an entity at all, in the sense that it only defines some state that is persistent, but you can't persist that thing in and of itself. You can't map that to a particular table. It only exists in the context of the subclasses that inherit that state. So a map superclass is essentially a way to map a bunch of state that will get shared by the subclasses, a That's why we call it a map superclass. It's a bunch of map state that you can reuse in the hierarchy below it. Wrong way. So here's a look at the map superclass called person. And here we actually have the ID defined in the map superclass. You can't actually instantiate a person. Normally, you know, a map superclass would be abstract even, because there's not really much point in making it concrete, being that you can't persist it. At any rate, here we have some state being defined here, the identifier particularly, which is the important thing, and then there's a name, and there's a relationship. Or an address, which is not strictly relationship, which is kind of an embedded object. Now, a customer extends person, and that is an entity. So the customer inherits all of the state, and the mapping is all applied to this customer class. Not only that, but all the defaults that apply to state that is mapped in an entity apply to state that is mapped in a map superclass. So I don't even have to annotate this name here. The default mapping for name applies. That may or may not actually, as Patrick mentioned, that may or may not be a good idea, given the database that you have. But at any rate, that's what we have in this person class, and that's what we'll get inherited by the customer. Furthermore, we have an employee that extends person, which defines yet another relationship here to a department. So the customer has a bunch of orders, an employee has a department, and they both have the stuff up here. And the map superclass allows us to share that mapped state without having to redefine it. If this was an entity, then we would be able to define something as a relationship to person or query across persons. But being that it's a map superclass, we're disallowing that. So here we actually are making an abstract class, which I think is really the more correct thing to do, except that we're making this an entity as well. So this is kind of a different way of doing the same thing. It allows you to query now across persons. It allows you to have a relationship to a person instead of to only one of its subclass, customer or employee. Okay, so I talked about earlier about management of entities and saying that, you know, they may or may not be managed. So what I meant was that if an entity belongs to a persistence context of an entity manager, then it really is managed. And that defines whether it's managed or not. A persistence context is like a set of entity instances that the entity manager knows about, that it is managing. So the definitions are complementary. As soon as you leave the persistence context, you are no longer managed. You are now in the detached state. So the persistence context kind of defines what's managed and what's not. And there can only ever be one instance of a given persistent identity in a persistence context. In other words, only one person for the given primary key of that person can be in any persistence context at one time. So there is only one Java object of that identity. So this is kind of a merging of the persistent identity with the Java identity inside of the persistence context domain. So we also heard about persistence units, which are the unit of configuration for entities. The persistence unit is helpful because it defines a bunch of configuration for a group of related entities, typically. And it will define such things as where you store these entities and which data source they go to or database. It'll define things like what transaction types you use for these entity managers that operate on these entities. It'll define actually, sometimes even define what the classes are, what the entities are for this persistence unit. Or that information may be discovered by the managing container or the provider for you. So depending on the environment, you may have to explicitly state what the entities are, or it may be detected. The way that you operate on the persistence context is through the Entity Manager API. So the persistence context is essentially managed by the entity manager. And when you operate doing persist or remove or anything else on the entity manager, you are actually affecting the persistence context. Okay, and if you query through an entity manager when there's a persistence context open, then all those objects will actually get loaded into the persistence context and become managed. So the persistence context is this thing that kind of represents the set of managed entities that an entity manager is aware of, and the entity manager kind of uses it to keep track of itself and to operate on entities with. The entity manager API itself allows you to do other things besides. It allows you to create queries because it's the factory from which you obtain query instances. It allows you to control the life cycle, essentially, of all of the entities within the persistence context. In terms of the life cycle itself, it's fairly simple. There's not a lot of life cycle states, but each of those states is somewhat difficult to understand in that it includes perhaps a little more than what the simple first intuitive thought is about that state. So new is actually quite simple. New is just, I new an entity up, I just create an entity using new, it's in the new state. That part's fairly simple. It's not managed yet, I haven't persisted it yet, I've just created it. On the other hand, persist means that I've actually put it in an entity manager, I've said persist to it. And so I'm in a kind of persisted state once it's managed. The implementation actually decides whether it wants to write that entity out to the database at the time that you persist it, or later on when you commit the transaction. Now, most providers that I know of will tend to defer that write. They'll tend to optimize that, wait till the end of the transaction, and then write everything out together. And that's the reason why you do that is because you don't have to start the database transactions early and hold up resources. This is a sort of a scalability issue. But nevertheless, there are still some implementations out there that especially when you look at the old EJB 2.1 implementations of CMP, there were some that used to, eagerly, whenever you saw a create on an entity, you had to write it out to the database. And so automatically, you had this eager writing happening. So the spec doesn't define or state that you must or must not use one approach or the other. In practice, of course, most people will defer. But in theory, you don't need to. Remove, well, that just does what you expect it to. But the removing of the entity puts it in a kind of a different state. And this is one of those things where I was telling you that it may not be quite so intuitive because you're sitting inside the persistence context. You're still managed, but you've been removed. You're this in kind of an intermediate state of having been removed and yet not necessarily been removed in the database. You may have been, or you may not have been. Once the transaction commits and you actually are removed in the database on commit time, then you would no longer be removed, actually. You're sort of in this kind of a new state or detached state, depending on how you look at it. But strictly speaking, you're really in a new state because you don't have a persistent identity. You don't exist in the database. Now, refresh is something that is valuable within a kind of certain specific domain where you essentially want this entity, the thing that you have in the persistence context, to represent what exactly is in the database. So this is a case where you may have other people jiggering with the data inside the database, and you've got this persistence context open, and you're operating on a bunch of entities, and someone somewhere somehow has done something to your data, and you want to take that data and refresh it from the database. So that's what that's used for. And merge is the operation that everybody talks about. That's the one where you can take an entity that you've taken perhaps onto another tier or in the same tier but out of a persistence context that's become detached and put it back into a persistence context. So merge is the key operation that allows you to take data and change it offline and be able to merge those changes back in to the database later on. It's all through the merge operation. The moment you take an entity out of its managed state and want to have those changes reflected back in the database at some point, you have to do one of two things. You have to take the state and put it in a managed entity, or you have to merge that state and make that become a managed entity of sorts. And merge is the operation that allows you to do that. So here's an example of a persist. The first thing you see here is that there's this funny persistence context annotation here, which says inject an entity manager into this field. So this obviously isn't an entity because you don't inject into entities themselves. You inject things into other managed components. This is actually a stateless session bean. So for those of you who saw the talk yesterday on components, you'll recognize a stateless session bean as being something you can inject into. And the thing we're injecting in this case is an entity manager. So once the session bean has an entity manager available to it, it wants to add a new order. And it's using a customer and product. So it takes this order, and it creates a new, or it takes this product rather, it creates a new order, passes the product in to the constructor. Nothing special about that. It takes a customer, and it adds the order to that customer. Well, that's nothing special at all. But now, in order for that customer to be, for that order to be persisted, I need to say persist on it. And that will actually cause that order to become managed and that at a transaction commit time be persisted. Now I'm returning the order here as a convenience so that it may be used for something else because I didn't actually pass an order in. So now once I take this order out, this order is managed as long as that persistence context is around. And that persistence context may be around dependent upon the transaction boundaries, depending upon a few other things as well. So the cascading is another option that allows you to take this object that you just had and let it be persisted without calling persist on it. So in this case, we have the same method, add new order. We're creating a new order. We've added it here, and we just returned it. Well, how does that work? Well, the customer we're assuming here is already managed. So we don't actually have to persist this object that we've created, this new order, because it's hanging off of this customer. And we've specified on the one-to-many of the orders that we should cascade persist. So as soon as we've added this order to the customer, and if that customer is already managed or part of the persistence context, then automatically this new order will become persistent at the end. So that's using a cascade to cause the persist to occur. Here we have a remove. So we're using a cascade remove now in addition to the persist. We have a bunch of line items on an order, and we're deleting an order. We want all the line items to be deleted also, because what's the sense of having a line item when you don't have the order for it to go on? So in this case, we find the order, passing in the order ID here. We find this order that we need, and then we remove it. That's just how you delete. You have to have the object to delete or to remove before you can actually remove it. And this removing will cause the line items of this order to be removed as well because we set cascade remove to be true. All right. Finally, we have a cascade merge. And the merge actually does the same sort of thing as the other cascading operations except that it happens on a merge operation. So in this case, we're updating an order. There's some changed order that we're bringing in. And this merge causes everything off of the order, including all of its line items, to be persisted, or merged in this case. So these are kind of some examples of how cascading can work. Cascading is something that you have to decide based on your domain model. It may or may not make sense to do cascading. Or it may make sense to do some cascades on some operations and not on others. So we talked about Java Persistence Query Language, or JPQL, as we refer to it. We mentioned it's like EJBQL. There's a bunch of stuff that we added in, and I'll just talk briefly about some of these. The projection is one that some people find quite useful, where you can just project a bunch of data from an entity and return that data directly. So we're selecting the name and of the employee and the department where the status of the employee is full-time. And we're doing a join at the same time. So the employee joined with the department, and we only care about the names of those two things. We're not actually returning both of those objects. We're just returning the two names of the employee and the department they're part of. So that's kind of useful. And the second one, Patrick showed an example of, where we actually return a non-entity object, some random persistent object that just happens to have a constructor defined with these types, we can pass that into the select statement and allow that thing to be returned with the data that we've selected inside of the constructor here. So in this case, we're doing a hodgepodge of information with the ID, the name, the salary, and the status, but also the name of the department, and we're calling this employee info because the department name wasn't actually stored in the employee. So we're creating like an employee info temporary structure or object to store these things in. And then we may want to do something or display them or pass them to some view later on to display. There's subqueries as well, which is fairly straightforward. You can just do a subquery within the original query on employees. In this case, we're doing a subquery for the a certain salary and the manager. Joins have become kind of, this is sort of one of these areas where the query languages become more useful and yet also simpler. So some things were made more explicit here. Before, you actually had some joining in EJBQL, but it was all implicit. You didn't really sort of see the joins. Joins just kind of happened. And you kind of had to be aware of that when you were defining EJBQL statements. What we've done in JPQL is define an explicit word join so that you can actually say when a join is happening and it becomes more clear to read, as well as allowing this outer join. So outer joins are something everybody basically had to use at some point or other and was missing from the spec. So now you can actually do an outer join. And the added feature here in this left outer join, or left is synonymous with the outer part, is the fetch part where you can actually take the things that you're joining to and cause those to be loaded in as well. So it's a way of eagerly loading this relationship through the query language. Furthermore, we introduced this notion of having a query statement that allowed you to perform an update on entities in the database without loading them into the persistence context. So in this case, I want to give everybody a raise of 10%. So I take the employee and I make this statement here that says increase its salary by 10%, where the name is that, and then at the end of the transaction, this will occur in the database, and I will never have loaded any of the employees necessarily. By the same token, you have to be careful because you may have a cache inside. The spec doesn't define how caching works apart from the persistence context itself. So depending on the vendor, you want to be careful exactly what you're doing. Some vendors will be a little more careful about what they do with their cache, for example, invalidating anything they may have in that cache automatically for you. And other ones may say, do this before you issue this query or do this after you issue this query or whatever. So this is one of those cases where you consult the vendor documentation for how to use this. But essentially, it's up to you to make sure you do this in the right frame of persistence contexts. And typically, you generally don't even want a persistence context around for this, or a short-lived one at least, so that you don't actually tramp over any other objects that you may have already loaded and have this data that had the old version of the salary inside of them. Now, delete is the same sort of thing, except you're just deleting, and I think deleting is actually less useful because I don't think that people actually delete large amounts of data in their database from inside the application. But anyway, there it is. And I find it very actually, you know what? I use this statement a lot, even though I say it's not very useful. The reason why I use it a lot is because it's great for testing. I can clear my database at the end of a test using one of these JPQL statements. And so I find that very, very handy. But the notion of having someone be able to push a button somewhere in a web interface and delete all my data scares me a little bit. So queries can also be static or dynamic. We saw this a little bit already. The annotations are named queries or a native query if you're using SQL directly, which you hope you won't. And they can be dynamic, and there's a case for using dynamic queries. But essentially, the named query is the main workhorse of queries. It's the most efficient query that you'll have. It'll be pre-compiled and prepared. It'll be bound in at compile time, it'll be compiled at deployment time and then bound in later on with the parameter data that you can pass in. So they're quite useful, they're quite performant, they're easy to use. You can use parameters with them, positional ones like JDBC uses with, you know, question mark one, blah, blah, blah. Or you can use actual named ones, which are much more convenient. They're more readable, easy to use, and they make your code much more easy to figure out. We talked about the Entity Manager as a factory for these things because there's an API on the Entity Manager called Query, or Create Query and Create Named Query, as well as a native variety of that too. And we saw that you can paginate through your query results as well and set limits on the number of results that you're obtaining from the query. So here's an example of a dynamic query. So again, we're injecting some entity manager somewhere in some probably a stateless session bean. And we have a method called findByZipCode that passes a person type and a zip. We create the query from this query statement here that is really based upon the zip code as the argument. This is the named parameter that we're using, and the zip itself is passed in as the argument to that. And we're passing the person type in here as the inheritance. So there may be different types of entities within the person hierarchy. So we're making use of this person type string to say which entity we're going to return. And then I bind the parameter in. So this zip code here says I look for the colon preceding the name that I'm passing in to the first argument of set parameter and zip code, and this is the thing I'm actually substituting for it, setting the max results. And get results list is the way that I actually execute this query. That will return a list of all of these results. And you can see here that they're being cascaded using this dot notation because each of these actually returns the query. So it just makes it a little more convenient. And for those of you who have used these languages that tend to cascade statements across a little more easily, then you'll find that perfectly natural and, as I say, much more convenient when it comes time to code. The way you define this query in a static query or a named query is using this named query annotation here, defining the name. And here we have customer find by zip code. The select C from customer C is exactly the same query string that we had before, but now we're actually predefining it or statically defining it as a named query. We can still have this argument, this parameter rather, that we can pass in an argument to, and when it comes time to do that, find customer by zip code, we just have to pass in the zip code and execute it and do the same sorts of things. Okay, so the ORM stuff, how much time do I have? I think I've got enough. The ORM stuff that we've standardized now is fairly straightforward, we hope. It makes use of a lot of defaults and has a lot of ease of use facilities within it, but still is very flexible, allows you to override those defaults whenever you need to define something that is different from what the container decides is the right thing for you. Now, the argument as to whether something goes into annotations or XML, I'm going to stay away from. Everybody has an opinion on that. I have an opinion on that. I think probably everybody in this room has an opinion on that. And me telling you what I think is not going to change what you think. So I won't even bother telling you what I think. If you care what I think, then you can ask me afterwards, and I'll be happy to tell you what I think. But annotations and XML, suffice it to say, are both available. So whatever you think, you should be happy. If you like annotations, you can do every single thing in annotations. If you like XML, you can do it all in XML. If you like some annotations and some XML, you can do that too. And if you like annotations just enough to use annotations but also want to override using XML, well, you can do that too. So the key is that everybody's happy and everybody has the flexibility to do what they want to do. The annotations themselves are divided into two kind of categories of annotation. The categories are the logical annotations that define what I kind of think of as a UML version of the model. You know, you kind of define the multiplicity and the relationships and that sort of thing. And then there's the physical annotations, which define the actual data side, what columns and tables they go to. All right? So these are some examples of those, the one to many, and these relationships that we saw, the primary key. This is again, kind of identity, a persistent identity in the model. I would say that a table and a column and these sorts of things are actually, join columns are actually examples of physical annotations. They talk about the database more than the object model. And the XML actually has a correlating side to it. The idea with the XML was that you wouldn't really have to kind of look up in this reference book as to how to program annotations or how to do the XML given the annotations. It should be a very reversible function given the thing that you're already using. So, for example, when you have a one-to-many annotation, if you want to convert that into an XML element, then you would simply apply this, you know, XML kind of overlay onto the annotation, and you know, you'd kind of come up with the XML element that you'd expect it to be. So what would you expect that to be, for example? Knowing what you all know about XML. Well, you'd probably expect that to be, you know, one with no, you probably wouldn't expect any uppercase characters, because you just don't do that in XML typically. And you like to use dashes when you separate words in XML. So you'd say, you know, one dash two dash many is what you'd expect to find in XML, and that's what you would find in XML. And same with all of the other annotations. There's this hopefully easy mapping that you can navigate through from one side to the other. The key about XML, though, that I would tell you now is that XML does provide you with one extra thing that annotations do not provide you with. The thing they offer you is the ability to define metadata at a level that is above the source level. So what I mean by that is, if you have a group of things together, such as a group of entities that you want to define something for, you can define those in an XML file as a default for that XML file. And that default will be applied to all those entities. You can't do that in annotation because there's nowhere to put that annotation. Okay, so if you want a persistence unit default, something that applies to all of the managed classes in a persistence unit, you would do that in the XML file. And if you didn't like XML, that'd probably be the only thing you had in your XML file for that. Again, I just mentioned that the defaults is a key to ORM, but they, again, can be overridden. You already know that relationships can be fetched lazily or eagerly. There is, again, lots of opinions on this. Essentially, lazy is a handy way to make a cut point in your object graph for loading. Not a point cut, but a cut point. So that you can actually stop all of your objects from being loaded in simultaneously or within the same database operation, as it were, even if it did, in fact, involve multiple database statements. We know about cascading because we saw examples of that already. Now, the cascading option that is global, Patrick said that, you know, he liked persistence by reachability. And, you know, he's not the only one. A lot of people like persistence by reachability. So you can define persistence to cascade across all of the entities in a persistence unit by setting one flag in an XML file. Okay, basic is the most basic type of operation, mapping operation that you have. In fact, not really an operation, but a mapping attribute. So it essentially says that this state is mapped to a column in the database. And it is so ubiquitous within the persistent entity that it's optional. You don't even have to say basic. If you don't say anything, it'll be assumed to be basic pretty much. So all the state that you have, if you're sort of happy with the things that you can define inside of the basic annotation, for example, if you're happy with the fetching of that thing, then you don't even have to say basic on it. You can just leave it alone, and it will become a basic, more than likely. I say more than likely because if it's not actually a basic field, if it was relationship or something, then you may be in for something different altogether. So all the basic Java types are there, and this is, you know, kind of why we called it basic. The column annotation is the thing that maps us to the database itself. So if you want to go to a different column from what the name is, then you'd use this column annotation. So here's an example of a customer. And the customer has all the state. To make this persistent, I can add these annotations onto it. So I've got the entity to say that it's an entity. I've got the ID to say where the primary key is. I've got this column here because the column in the database is not called C_rating. It's actually called credit. and I've got this lob to say that this actually is a large object. And this is a serializable thing, so it actually will be stored as a binary large object in the database. So this, all this information tells the provider exactly how to map back and forth reading and writing to the database from this object. The customer defaults to the customer table, because that's just the name of the entity. So once again, all these things just go to where you want them to. And if they don't go to where you want them to, then it's up to you to change where they go to. Here's the XML equivalent of it. For the XML lovers, we specify the class. We specify the different attributes in here with the ID, the basic for credit rating, and this is the name of the column that we're going to, and then that this is a lob. I defaulted here the name, but I didn't put any annotations on there, and likewise in XML, I don't say anything about the name there either. So the same defaults apply in XML as apply in annotations. And that's what you expect. Relationships go with the usual types of relationships, as I mentioned, for single entities and collections of entities, with those hopefully intuitive annotations. But the physical annotations here are join column and join table, because, again, a relationship means that there must be some column that is a foreign key to another table. So here we have an order and a customer, and the order has a relationship to a customer. So we have a foreign key in the custom, in the form of a customer ID column in order. Now, given what I told you before about owning sides and inverse sides, what would you guess about the owner or the inverse side of this relationship? Well, you would know because you remember very carefully that I mentioned that the owning side had the foreign key in it. So you'd say, ah, that's easy. The owners of this relation, or the owner of this relationship is the order, because it has a foreign key in it. So here's our many to one annotation that says its relationship and the other stuff. The order defaults to the order table, ID defaults to that. And this many to one doesn't have any join column annotation on it because it's making use of the default join column. The default join column says, well, I'll just take the name of this field and append it with an underscore and the name of the primary key that you're referencing. So this is a foreign key to this primary key of customer. So it's going to take this, append an underscore with the name of this customer, primary key, and assume that that's the foreign key. So it'll point to this, which we know in the database actually is a foreign key to that. Now, if that wasn't called custID, then I would actually have to use a join column annotation. I put adjoin column, and I put the name of the column that I have to use as my foreign key. And here's the XML, where we just have the many to one, and the name is the customer. It's the same thing, right? So what about the other side? If we have a customer that has a bunch of orders, we already see that our order is here. We went over that already. But on the customer side, we need our one-to-many annotation with the map by that tells us what the other side of the relationship is. So this is the thing that links the two sides together. And once again, cust points to this field right here called cust. So customer there, ID there. And here, the mapped by says, oh, I'm not mapping this. This is actually mapped by the order entity, and it's mapped by the cust field of that or attribute of that entity. And it's the cust that actually defines, once again, that we saw in the last slide, what the foreign key is and how it goes back to the ID again is in the database. So it all kind of fits together. Here's the XML where we just have one to many, the name, and again the map by. So notice the only extra piece we have here is the name. Well, that's pretty clear because we don't actually have the code that we're annotating. So here we actually have the orders that we're annotating, so we can look and see what the thing we're annotating is. But in XML, there is no context. We have to state that explicitly, saying it's the orders attribute. Finally, we come to the many-to-many case. Many-to-many case is a little special because no one really has the foreign key in their table. You need this other table called the join table. And so which side is the owning side and which side isn't? Well, it's up to you. You can actually decide that randomly. Your choice. In this case, we're actually saying, well, we'll just make the customer the owner of this relationship. How do we know that? Because this guy is the one that has the map by. So he must be the inverse side of this relationship. So the tables look like this. And why do they look like that? They look like that because the owning side is the customer side. So the default name of the join table is the owning side underscore the inverse side, which is phone. That's how we come up with this. This is all generated automatically for us. This is what we're going to assume. If we actually made the owning side this side, and this be the map by or the inverse side, then this would be called phone underscore customer. And the same rules to the foreign keys apply that applied in the many-to-one case or the other join column case. Right? We just take the name of the field and append the underscore with the primary key underneath it. That's all there is to it. What happens if our table wasn't called that? We never had a table called customer phone. It was called cust phone. And it wasn't called cust's ID, it was called cust ID or phone ID. Because DBAs have their own way of naming things. So join table actually is an annotation in this case. We can't assume the default join table. We have to define what the join table is. So we're naming the join table as a cust phone. That's the name of the table. And the join columns are, first of all, the owning join column is cust ID. And then the inverse join column is phone ID. And we're done. So you see why kind of this owning side and inverse side becomes important to understand. Because whenever you aren't using the defaults and you need to override those defaults with the actual database names that may be different, then you kind of have to specify these things in those terms. So here's the XML again. The difference here is that the join table is specified explicitly. And again, you see all the same information here. The difference is you have to specify the actual name here in the many-to-many because for the same reason you have to specify the context. Okay, actually, yeah, there was. I forgot I even had embedded objects on here. So this is one more mapping that we can go through. This is the one where I actually have a customer and I've got a customer info in here, but that customer info is all stored in the same table. That's the embedded object case. So my name and my credit, my photo is actually part of here in the same table. I'm just having an object called info. So the moment we use this embedded thing that we saw earlier, and the embedded object itself, it gets annotated with an embeddable. Embeddable gets mapped just like an entity would. So all these defaults apply, and I need to use the lob annotation here to indicate that's a large object. And so the customer, the same default table name applies, the ID applies, but this thing actually says, oh, this is an embedded, go to that object to see what state gets mapped and how it gets mapped. And then all those things are mapped to the table in the same way that any entity would have been. And that's the, so it's all fairly easy to do. In terms of defining, and it's fairly natural defining an embedded object and how it maps. The same rules apply. XML version, again, is fairly simple. You just say what the embedded thing is, and here you just call it embeddable instead of an entity. And that just says, I don't expect an ID in here because the ID is the thing that's embedding me. Okay? So we talked a little bit about inheritance. In this case, there is actually we can look at the ways you can represent inheritance on the OR mapping side, where you can have three different ways. You can define things in a single table, you can join them across multiple tables in the entity hierarchy, or you can denormalize all of your data and have them in a separate table per entity with all the shared data included in every table. So here's the object model where we had our animal. And we got some shared state and some non-shared state. The way you look at this in the different data models is in a single table, it all gets stored in the same table. And you have some, whenever you have a land animal, then the wingspan will be nulled out, right? So there's some wastage going on there. But this is actually the most common and in most cases the most efficient way of accessing data. So it's a little bit worse on storage because you've got all these rows that have nulled columns out. So it's not always the best that way, but as I say, it's certainly one of the most common ways of representing inheritance in the database. The join one is the next most common one, where you actually take all the normalized state or inherited state that is common into an animal table, and even though animal is abstract, it has a table. So all of the shared state is you would never instantiate an animal, but you join the land animal with the animal or the air animal with the animal to combine together to get the actual state of any one of those objects. And then finally, the seldom used type, which isn't actually required in the specification at all, but is at least spec'd out, so in the future we might require it, is this table per class scheme, where you actually, as I said, take all the data and repeat the ID and the name in each of those tables. So, of course, this one is not used very often because if you ever want to do a query over you know, animals, then you know, you have to do this big join depending on how wide your inheritance hierarchy is. Okay, I think we're running short on time here. We got about 5 minutes left, 10 minutes left, something like that. I don't know. Yeah? Okay, so we're almost done. We'll talk a little bit about the Java SE mode, where you can take Java Persistence API and run it outside a container altogether. So obviously you're not going to have, you know, injection of entity managers like you did in the container inside your session means. But you may have some other similar type of functionality. For example, if you're using, you know, Spring, then you can actually, it will go ahead and inject these things in sort of its usual way of injection. But the API itself is essentially, you have to have some place to start. Given that there's not a deployment process, some formalized way of getting everything going into a container, you have to have some way to get the factory, the entity manager factory that gets used to create entity managers from. So there's also this other transaction scheme, because outside the container, you don't always have a Java transaction API available to you or some transaction manager that gives you such a thing. So you use these local resource type transactions. We call resource local, which is essentially just going to the JDBC level driver and, you know, getting a database transaction. So that's kind of the standard transaction you'd use in the Bootstrap API case. And, well, this point on the bottom is essentially that a more in-depth point, really, that says that the persistence context rules are slightly different for using application-managed entity managers outside of the container. So this transaction API that you use outside the container is called the entity transaction. And the application actually controls that transaction a lot more closely than it does using JTA. In JTA, the transaction may start and be terminated without you even knowing about it. So it may be started before you got there, and it may finish after you left. But you just kind of register and list yourself in with the JTA transaction. The entity manager kind of joins in. But in this case, in the entity transaction case, it's the entity manager that actually has the API for demarcating the transactions. So the API is begin, commit, set rollback only. All these exist on the entity transaction API. And you can get an entity transaction from the entity manager itself. So the persistence, the Java X.persistence.persistence is this Bootstrap class that says, here's how you can get an entity manager factory, which gives you an entity manager, which is the thing you really want. And you pass in the particular configuration or persistence unit name that you need. It's responsible for finding out what provider supports that persistence unit. And the provider may be specified in there or it may not be. And it may, you know, end up finding the first one it finds and just use that one. Explicitly, you can say which provider, which implementation, if you have multiples, actually supports this. So the entity manager factory itself, it has an API on it to create an entity manager, and you're up and running. So here's an example where the salary changer here allows you to change your salary. So you don't have to be limited to 10% in this case. You can change it to whatever you want, and I won't stop you. But you may be stopped anyway, depending on your permissions to access that persistence unit HR system. But essentially, the persistence in this dot underneath here got displaced somehow. This is actually a method on persistence, this create entity manager factory. And this is the name of the persistence unit. So I'm looking for the persistence unit called HRSystem, which is defined in a persistence XML file. That's where the configuration for that persistence unit is defined. And the createEntityManager then is invoked on that EntityManager factory, which gives me an EntityManager. Once I get that, then I'm off and running. I say get transaction begin. I do a find off an employee, which I'm hoping is me. I set the salary to whatever I passed in on the command line, which is the second thing I passed in. I guess I passed in the employee ID first. And then I commit it. And then I close my resources off. So that's kind of a simple, I mean, there's not a lot of error checking going on there. I mean, all sorts of things could have happened in the middle and things could have blown up. But it's just kind of a simple program here that we've written to make use of this thing, and it's complete in the sense where it'll actually do something. So that's pretty easy to use. That's a complete program using persistence. So the summary is that entities are simple. They're just regular POJOs. Basically, any POJO you have can become an entity if you want it to be. You just have to make sure it's got an identifier along with it. You can take them and move them around. You can modify them, put them back, change them inline. You can keep them managed and change them that way. The Entity Manager itself is a simple API for operating on them. And what that means is that you don't have to go all over the place to do things. This is basically a gateway for operating over your lifecycle of your entities. Most people we expect will be using this inside the container. That's sort of why it's part of the Java EE specification right now, because that's where people use persistence. There's the occasional user that has a direct client-side fat client application. They can use it, but I think we expect the real reason we did this was so that you can test these things outside the container. That's kind of the real raison d'etre for having the Bootstrap API. Again, the standards are the big win. So you may be using a persistence provider already, whether it be Toplink or Hibernate or Kodo or some other one that you may have been using in the past. But you can now actually migrate to the JPA standard and be allowed to change providers anytime you want. And if you're using one that just isn't scalable or that doesn't offer a feature that you like, you can actually change if you go to the JPA and try other ones out without actually hurting your application.